English translation. As long as the great, powerful son of Abhimanyu remains the emperor of the world, there is no chance that the personality of Kali will flourish. Prabhupada's purport. As we have already explained, the personality of Kali has entered the jurisdiction of this earth long ago, and he was looking for an opportunity to spread his influence all over the world. But he could not do it satisfactorily due to the presence of Maharaj Lordship. That is the way of good government. The disturbing elements like the personality of Kali will always try to extend their nefarious activities, but it is the duty of the able state to check them by all means. Although Maharaj Pritchett allotted places for the personality of Kali, at the same time he gave no chance for the citizens to be swayed by the personality of Kali. Om Agyanam Tridam Dasya Janang Janashlakaya Taksho Om Mityamyena Tasmai Sri Gurve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manovrishtam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Garamayam Dharati Svapadantikam E Krishna Kuruna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagapate Gopisha Gopikanta Radha Kanta Namustite Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Sasvati Devi Gurvani Pracharine Nivasesha Shunyavadi Prashachate Satadine Jai Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gradha Sivasadi Gur Bhaktivinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. The English translation to that verse again. As long as the great powerful son of Abhimanyu remains the emperor of the world, there is no chance that the personality of Kali will flourish. So, of course, Maharaj Pritchett was the son of Abhimanyu. Abhimanyu himself, of course, was the late son of Arjuna. So, effectively, of course, Maharaj Pritchett was in the line of the Pandavas, very much so, and he'd inherited this kingdom. But, of course, Yudhisthira had left the throne, and he was left with this very difficult job to try and maintain the Vedic Dharma around the world. And yet, with Kali's advancing, though now, of course, in the early stages, by this time, Krishna had left the world, the Mahabharata war had finished, many of the great leaders and great personalities had also left during the war, of course. Krishna had gone, Balaram had gone. So Maharaj Pritchett had this huge, huge responsibility to maintain Vedic Dharma throughout the entire civilized world, known world. And yet he was practically, yes, he had his armies, but it must have been a very lonely experience for him, so much against the odds. And yet he was still in the line of the Pandavas, Arjuna's grandson, basically. He was powerful. He was potent. And, of course, we have to understand a little bit, I think, about the cultural and the geographical context of this. We have to understand that Hastinapur, of course, was still the capital at that time of Bharatvarsh. But Bharatvarsh, what we today call India, of course, was a lot larger 5,000 years ago than it is today. You know, borders and so forth are very different kind of entities. So, for example, the Bharatvarsha, that Maharaj Pritchett would have had jurisdiction over a huge, huge kingdom right across Asia, actually, right across the civilized world. And most of the population at the time was actually in what we would now call India or thereabouts, or, you know, at least Central Asia. The rest of the world, Europe, for example, was, these were basically outposts. They were being, of course, they were still influenced by Vedic culture, but to a lesser degree as you got further away from Bharat. So basically, Bharat was the world. Sometimes in Vedic literature, you'll find that references to Bharat can also mean the world. It can also mean India. Because basically, 5,000 years ago, India was the world, or the center of the civilized world, the Vedic culture, the Dharma. And here's Maharaj Pritchett here, basically, doing his best to basically uphold that against all odds, it would seem. Because Kali's time was coming and he had to find a way of getting in. Marj Pritchard, of course, had different ideas of his own. Of course, at that time, informal yugas and people could, you know, people in Bharatvas, you know, very much more in touch with these things, mysticism. They could, people could see demigods. Demigods would even come to the earth at the time. But now, of course, with the outset of Kali Yuga, the demigods stopped coming to the earth. So Marj Pritchard really had an uphill struggle, and yet he used all his power, all his might, and all his armies. And sometimes he would have to rule with an iron fist, because all around him were these various kingdoms that would, of course, that the system was they would offer a Rajasura sacrifice to Yudhisthira or whoever was on the throne at the time to pledge allegiance to the supreme king at Hastinapur. And Pritchard had kind of inherited that throne of emperor, of being the emperor. However, the earth was not what it was. It wasn't what it was. It must have been very, very difficult. I just wanted to kind of, we also have to understand, I think, the, just to kind of make this more relevant for today, the ideal government is a very, very important point here. Prabhupada mentions in his purport, what is the way of a good government? The way of a good government is to basically check by all means disturbing elements. For example, animal slaughter would have been a very disturbing element from a Vedic Dharmic point of view. Gambling, prostitution, intoxication. These things were simply not tolerated by Marj Pritchard. But obviously what was going on, he was having to go out with his armies, and not just through force, but actually through example. Often 90% of leadership was, if not more than 90%, is actually through example, through practice, where the citizens were inspired by their emperor. And how did that happen? There was a symbiotic relationship between the Kshatriyas, the ruling class, and the Brahmanas. This was the essence, the foundation of Vedic culture. It is described in the Bhagavatam that Marj Pritchard, and in Prabhupada's purport, that Marj Pritchard was very, very respectful towards the Brahmanas up until a bit later, as we will soon learn. But the so that was the basis. So the spiritual energy, if you like, the intelligentsia, the ministers, the advisors, was actually coming from the Brahminical class, and they were following purely, they were setting a good example. And the Kshatriyas, they could be a little bit more in the mode of passion, but still they had to set an example. And the way they did that was by following and respecting the Brahmanas. So the relationship between the Kshatriyas and the Brahmanas was absolutely fundamental to Vedic civilization. And therefore, the other people, the other Varnas and so forth, were inspired by this and would follow. But as we learn, Kali had his objective. Kali was on the march. Kali was on the march. So let's learn a bit more about that. We also understand that, of course, I wanted to give a briefly mention actually to the fact that it's Bhishma Ashtami today. Well, in India it's tomorrow, but it's actually technically in the UK today. And that's when, of course, the Pandavas offered their final rites to Bhishmadev as he passed away. He left his body, of course, on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. And, of course, that is a well-known thing. And in India, people would offer a shroud to their fathers and grandfathers. Of course, Bhishma being the ultimate grandfather. So there was a connection there. But, of course, it wasn't just Bhishma who passed away, you know, but the Pandavas had left the planet by this time. And Krishna, most important of all, Krishna had left this planet. And so therefore it was fair game for Kali. But we understand, we actually read from earlier verses actually, that Pritchard was kind of, he actually met Kali by the river Saraswati, which is good geographically, and not that far from Hastinapur. So Kali was getting close, his influences, Kali's ways, his personality, the way that obviously people were starting to behave was disturbingly close to Hastinapur. So Pritchard was, and then he actually saw Kali torturing a bull and a cow, and he burst in there straight away and was very, very angry. You dare kill an innocent bull and cow, Kali, for this you will die this very day. Like this. Bit of a drama, dramatic license there for Bruce. And Kali was very suddenly, of course, when it suited him, became very, very falsely humble. Oh, please don't kill me, please don't kill me. And of course, Marge Pritchard, again, being a leader, setting the example, could not kill someone who was basically, you know, a Kshatriya would not kill someone who was running away or had their back to you or did not have the same weapon. And here was Kali, although a very, very, you know, the arch enemy, of course, of all Dharma. And yet here he was crawling at Marge Pritchard's feet saying, please don't kill me, please be merciful. So Pritchard had to be merciful. He said, all right, I will not kill you. But you cannot be here in my kingdom. Get ye hence. Get out of here. You know, you're not welcome on the earth. You're not certainly not welcome in Bharat with your undharmic ways or kind of atheistic behavior, your intoxication and so forth. And Kali said, well, where can I go? There must be somewhere on the earth I can linger. And Pritchard replied, all right. Wherever you can find, we find prostitution, gambling, intoxication, and animal slaughter, that's where you can reside. And Kali went, thank you, my lord, paid some obeisances, and then did a runner, got out of there. Of course, he was preparing for a later kind of move. And Pritchard thought, well, what I'll do is I'll just rule with an iron fist and make sure my predecessors also rule like this, and we'll make sure that Kali simply will not enter. So there was a compromise. At the same time, it was quite clear, at least at the time, that nothing was going to basically sway this kind of this good government, as Papa describes, this dharmic government, this pious government, that even if it meant through perhaps some degree or an exhibition of power, of force, was to stop the population and the outer provinces of Bharat and so forth from being... basically turning away from Dharma. This is what Prabhupada describes as government. You know, it's not soft, it's not sentimental. Kshatriyas were not sentimental. Perhaps some brahmanas were gentle like that, but not a king, not a ruler. Because if you're too soft as a leader or as an emperor, then people take advantage of you. And of course, not least, Kali would take advantage, all the things that Kali represents. So, of course, we know that full of confidence, but Kali was infiltrating the subconscious, if you like, the consciousness of the population. It was his yuga, after all. It's his time by providence. So somehow or other, one day, of course, Pritchett was caught off guard. He actually offended Shamika. He was a very, very hot day. He turned up at his hermitage, expected to receive water, perhaps even, you know, an offerable chair. But that yogi, that sage, was deep in meditation. So deep in meditation that yogi, that sage, didn't even notice the emperor of the world walk into his hermitage. And then, I suppose you could say by yogamaya arrangements, or whatever it was, perhaps someone can tell me, Marge Pritchett just basically got into some type of maya, some type of illusion, and grabbed a snake and put it around the neck of the sage. And then he went away without any water. So Sringi, Shamika's, the sage's son, saw what had happened and was absolutely outraged, absolutely disgusted. And being a young boy, perhaps being a little bit immature and emotional. So first of all, here's the fault of the Kshatriyas. They didn't honor the Brahmins. Then the Brahmins misused their cursing power. Sringi got out his Brahmin thread. He was only a young boy and said, I curse Marge Pritchard to be killed in 7 days by the snake bird Takshaka, a Takshaka mantra. And that's what he chanted. And that Takshaka mantra, in those days the Brahmins had those type of powers. If a Brahmin or a sage or someone like that cursed you, it meant something because they had the purity. And yet he was the beginning of the influences of Kali, getting into the Brahmin class themselves, cursing worthy emperors just because of a relatively small error. And yet because of that small error by Marge Pritchard, all was lost. And of course, when Marge Pritchard found out about this, of course, he sought the lotus feet of Sugadeva Goswami, and of course, we get the Bhagavatam, as we all know, as we're all aware. So this is basically, once Marge Pritchard had left the planet, then of course, Kali was very, very happy about that. His plan was beginning, his devilish plan actually, was beginning to unfold, and Kali was getting stronger. Of course, in the verse, what does it say again? As long as the powerful son of Abhimanyu, that's Maharaj Prithvi, was emperor of the world, there was no chance the personality of Kali would flourish. So Kali was present, but he couldn't flourish. But of course, Prithvi had been bitten by the snake bird Takshaka, and that was it, he'd gone. His body actually burst into flames. So Prithvi's son, Jambijaya, actually took over. And Jambijaya, of course, being in the line, the great-grandson of Arjuna, was still a very potent and a strong warrior. And but at the same time, I think around that time and onwards, and as the generations passed, Kali basically got more and more powerful. This is Jambijaya was actually, I was reading about him the other day, he was actually someone who was also ruling very, very strongly. He was, again, but at that point it was, you know, I suppose Kali was, you know, the other outer provinces, outer regions were becoming increasingly less respectful, let's say, to the throne of Hastinapur and so on and so forth. So the rest is history. This is the downfall of Dharma, the downfall of Bharat, and the influences, the strengthening of the age of Kali. Actually, it's quite interesting that if you actually leap forward now, we were talking about the Bhagavatam, we're now here in the first canto. So actually we're going to leap now to the 12th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, because in there, the first six verses of chapter 2 of the 12th canto, we read all about the symptoms of the age of Kali. And these things started to come in, of course, more and more and more. So from, say, around the beginning of Kali, of course, up until recently, or until now, all these things have basically flourished. So let's read from verses 1 to 6, chapter 2 of the 12th canto. It reads, O King, religion, truthfulness, cleanliness, tolerance, mercy, duration of life, physical strength, and memory were all diminished day by day because of the powerful influence of the age of Kali. In Kali Yuga, wealth alone will be considered a sign of man's good birth, proper behavior and fine qualities, and law and justice will be applied only on the basis of one's power. So we can see already by just, I'll do the other verses in a moment, but already what was starting to happen was that people started to have a much more materialistic outlook on life. People become, because when you turn away from spiritual life or spiritual culture, what you have, of course, is materialistic culture, which is enhanced, which is facilitated, which is founded by the breaking of the principles of which Kali, you know, the animal slaughter and so forth. And this clouds the minds of the population, and people basically become blind, spiritually blind, and therefore those that have some material attributes become more worshipable than those of the sages. So the foundation of society and the priorities and what is valued starts to shift. And this is very, very typical of the age of Kali. In fact, we can see that so much today. It's so clear. Let's continue. Men and women will live together merely because of a superficial attraction. And success in business will depend on deceit. Womanliness and manliness will be judged according to one's expertise in sex. And a man will be known as a Brahman just by him wearing a thread. So again, more superficiality. The idea of wearing the Brahman thread was a sacred thing, and it meant, but being a Brahmana meant you had to behave a Brahmana, live as a Brahmana. And yet what was happening was the Varna and Ashram system, which was prevalent in existence in before the Kali Yuga and worked very nicely, as I mentioned, the foundation built with the Kshatriyas and their relationship with the Brahmanas. Suddenly more and more unqualified Brahmanas started to emerge, and people call themselves Brahmanas merely by their birth and nothing else. So, of course, today we can recognize this as being the caste system, which is different from Varna and Ashram system. It is a degraded Kali Yuga version, if you like, of Varna and Ashram. But we shouldn't mix the two together, as some people do or some literatures do, because it's such a degraded form of what Krishna actually originally spoke about and what was actually practiced at the height of Vedic times, that it's fairly unrecognizable by Kali's arrangement. A person's spiritual position will be ascertained merely but according to external symbols, And on the same basis, people will change from one spiritual order to the next. A person's propriety will be seriously questioned if he does not earn a good living. And one who is very clever at juggling words will be considered a learned scholar. So it's no one's interested. If you just sound like you know what you're talking about, if you're able to quote from different sources, you actually go, well, you know, but you may not know what you're talking about, not have the true authority. And yet those people will be considered to be great learned people. And sages, renunciates, those who want to live a more simple life, live more close to nature, will basically be ignored, underestimated, and people will of course, offend them. It says, people will change from one spiritual order to the next. But this is understanding when one takes initiation from the guru, which is a very, very serious bond between you, the guru, and also the sampradaya, or the tradition of which that guru exists, that lineage, Quran, Quran. So that in the Kali Yuga, people will take initiations very, very lightly, go from one spiritual order to the next, not having any sense of loyalty to one spiritual teaching. It is actually, you know, if one is initiated, it is better in one sense if one's initiated by a sincere lineage, one of the bona fide sampradayas, is the idea is that once you're initiated into a sampradaya, a bona fide one, then you follow that to the best of your ability. But in the Kali Yuga, people basically are not committed to whatever path or religion, or tend to dedicate themselves. If they do dedicate themselves to anything, it's tending to be something which is not a bona fide sampradaya and is basically a concoction, or is not spiritually beneficial, or is so lenient. For example, oh, you can eat as much meat as you like, it's okay, God still loves you. You know, these type of philosophies, again, are symptoms of the Kali Yuga. More 12 canto verses here. A person will be judged unholy if he does not have money, and hypocrisy will be accepted as virtue. Marriage will be arranged simply by a verbal agreement, and a person will think he is fit to appear in public if he's merely taken a bath. Again, all these things are pretty clear. We can see these very much today. So someone will be unholy if they're rich, then they're basically holy. Oh, someone is a great person. We listen to this person because he's a multi-millionaire. That must be right. Then he must know what he's talking about. He must be following Dharma. But this sage over here, oh, he's just sitting in his hermitage. He's got nothing to offer. He's just a hippie. Or what, a beggar, I think is probably a better word. Of course, to be fair, it is the right of the hermits and the sages and the Brahmins to actually educate society. So they should not be begging for the sake of begging. They have to inspire people to give to them. But again, another kind of another problem. A sacred place will be taken to consist of no more than a reservoir of water located at a distance. And beauty will be thought to depend on one's hairstyle. I haven't got much hair myself, so. Filling the belly will become the goal of life. Get me again, that is. And one who is audacious will be accepted as truthful. He who can maintain a family will be regarded as an expert man. And the principles of religion will be observed only for the sake of reputation. So very, very interesting points there, I believe. He who can maintain his family will be regarded as expert. Of course, what that means is that in the Kali Yuga, it is very difficult to maintain a family. Of course, maintaining a family is a fundamental thing, is a fundamental aspect of Dharma. But of course, to actually maintain it nowadays is seen as being a great achievement. It says here marriage will be arranged simply by verbal agreement. And so in other words, marriage in the Kali Yuga tends to lose its sacred nature, and families tend to lose their sacred nature as well, and people don't prioritize the family values. But actually, these things are important. So let us continue. I've got this quite interesting visit there to the 12th canto. One of my favorite cantos, actually, 12th canto. But going back, all these things started to happen, and not just now, of course, we're referring to modern times, but actually these things had been going on for, ever since the last 5,000 years. It's historically, of course, we know that it wasn't so. Even within Yudhisthira's time, there were many inauspicious signs of Kali's influence. There was, you know, Yudhisthira was a great believer, of course, in omens and truthfulness. And he was noticing, you know, that the howling of wolves at certain times, or the formation of weather was starting to change even. Of course, all these things, again, are symptoms of Kali. There's earthquakes and floods and droughts. So the Sarasvati River, for example, that Marjapukshit met Kali at, that begins, of course, to dry up. In fact, today the Sarasvati River is not visible on land. It is obviously just underground. And yet we know the Sarasvati, there are some scholars, again, they're kind of word jugglers, let's say, who don't even believe the Sarasvati River ever existed. And yet the Sarasvati River is mentioned numerous times in Vedic text as a sacred river, even here in the Bhagavatam. And also with NASA satellite photographs and so forth, you can actually see where the Sarasvati River used to be, because there's a slight indentation, assumingly, but it's underground. Again, as a Kali Yuga goes by, much more, that will happen to all the sacred rivers eventually. We're not so much into the Kali Yuga at present. We still have the Ganges, for example, and so forth. But a decline in morals, of course, in leaders. Bharat Varsh became, I suppose, superseded by other empires, the Egyptians, for example, and Persian empires, and all these other world civilizations, but were influenced, or everything's ultimately influenced by the Vedas, Dharma, but Vedic culture was around the whole world. But more and more civilizations started to spring up around the world, and India's culture became less centralized, let's say, much more so before. But India itself, the Dharmic decline started to produce, of course, Buddhism, Lord Buddha came, and there was Jainism, the Mahavira, and so forth, because people said, this has gone a different way, this is so degraded now, we have to kind of revisit or try to reset some of these teachings. That people were killing cows, people were killing animals for sacrifice in the name of the Vedic text. And so Buddha had to come, especially actually into Gaya area, into very north India where Nepal is, there was animal slaughter and rituals. In fact, until quite recently, mass animal slaughter was taking place in the name of Dharma. Lord Buddha had to come and stop these things by taking people away from the Vedas, because people's understanding, people become so degraded, the so-called Brahmanas, not saying that all Brahmanas were wrong, but there was many, many, let's say, false Brahmanas that were misunderstanding, misconstruing, and misrepresenting the Vedic text. So there had to be different branches, if you like, of Dharma that would come about. And then we get to 12th canto. Actually, I wanted to mention a little bit here. 12th canto, chapter 1 this time, verse 34, an interesting extract here. It describes that what was going on, it describes the ongoing moral decline. For example, 34 of chapter 1, 12th canto, the land along the Sindhu River, because today I think they call that the Indus River, will be ruled by Sudras, fallen brahmanas and meat-eaters. Having given up the path of Vedic civilization, they would have lost all spiritual strength. There will be many such uncivilized kings ruling at the same time, O King Richard, and they will all be uncharitable, possessed of fierce tempers, and great devotees of religion and falsity. So not great devotees of Krishna, but great devotees of irreligion and falsity. These barbarians in the disguise of kings will devour the citizenry, murdering innocent women, children, cows and brahmanas, and coveting the wives and property of other men. Of course, here we're talking about invasions and wars and so forth, where the kshatriyas, or so-called kshatriyas, of the Kali Yuga will not be noble as Pritchard was noble, or Yudhisthira was noble, but probably had more in common with Duryodhana, actually. King Vena. They basically were disinterested in power, interested in their own ego, but prepared to conquer others. They allow their soldiers to kind of basically pillage other kingdoms and dominate through oppression and tyranny. So again, very much Kaliyuga. And it, the verse goes on. They will be erratic in their moods, have little strength of character, and will be very short-lived. Indeed, not purified by any Vedic rituals and lacking in the practice of regulatory principles, they will be completely covered by the modes of passion and ignorance, the lower modes of nature. The citizens governed by these low-class kings will imitate the character, behavior, and speech of their rulers. That's actually, when you think about it, a very, very telling line. It's quite interesting. The citizens will imitate the character, behavior, and speech of their rulers. So what's emphasized here, in fact, this has been the theme throughout, isn't it? It's the rulers that actually carry the example. They're the ones that actually carry the responsibility for their citizens. That's the whole point. It's not about citizens to be taxed and then to be taxed out of existence and then abused, and that the rulers would basically immerse themselves in sense gratification and Adamic behavior. No, it was that they were actually supposed to set the right example. And when the rulers degraded, and India's kings of various dynasties, of course, there was an assassination in the Kurojana dynasty, as described in the 12th century. So the lineage, the Pandava lineage, let's say, had broken by then as the Kaliyuga went by, and things, of course, further degraded. But it's interesting the citizens, the average citizen, needs to have a role model in their life. That's basically a very important principle. And if the Kshatriyas are not following any kind of respect of anything, then what chance has anyone got, quite honestly? And this is, and of course, we look at this history, we have this idea, don't we, of a certain, at least a kind of a devotee's way of looking at history, which of course is true history. The idea that we are actually in a more degraded situation today than we were around the world 5,000 years ago, at least Bharat. We were told that actually it's the other way around, that we're actually becoming more civilized, that we're actually in some way at the peak of civilization, because now we have social media, now we have mobile phones, now we have the internet. Of course, I'm not saying these are bad things because I'm using it, but we have all these things, now we have all this tech that makes us superior to the ancient hermits of old. But actually, this is not the case, actually, because what we're using is gross technology. And whereas in those times, particularly including the Pandavas and certainly the powerful Brahmanas, they had a lot of mystic powers, mystic technology, mystic weapons, celestial weapons, the demigods even. And of course, Brahmanas had all kinds of telepathic powers, the power to curse, the power to bless, and all kinds of things like that. It's just that we've lost that subtle, and certainly that spiritual way of manipulating the world around us, or using the world around us. So we've resorted to technology and gross things just involved with manipulating matter. So weaponry, for example, or certainly how we live our lives is more immersed in these things. But everything, remember, can be used in Krishna's service. So that's right, even your laptop, even your mobile phone, and even Zoom can be used, especially Zoom actually, can be used in Krishna's service. That's the saving power, actually. As long as we, of course, are following the teachings of Lord Caitanya, Lord Caitanya would say, in some ways, this age of Kali, if we follow Lord Caitanya and chant Hare Krishna, we can actually be considered fortunate. There are good things about the age of Kali, despite all those nasty things I've been talking about. Still, there are some perks. There are some perks. Just like, for example, it's you have a very rainy, stormy day, for example, and you have an umbrella, and that you have a nice umbrella. So it's Lord Titania's umbrella, which is sheltering us from the reign of Kali. Reign as in both leadership and also the weather reign. And yet, people, it's so difficult if you tell people this version of history, which I've basically given. Even information about the Vedic Empire and all the rest of it, the significance of Bharat in ancient times. People find it hard to believe because they've been taught a different narrative, frankly speaking. And that narrative ultimately is designed to enhance one's sense gratification, ultimately, because it justifies, you know, we're the best, this is what we're going to do. But actually, another aspect of Kali Yuga is the increasing of the four defects, not just in each and every one of us, but the four defects of society, of scientists, of scholars. I was asked to mention a bit about Vedic science, so I'll touch a little bit on that if I may. The science and scholars, the defects they have is the tendency to cheat. For example, if someone is presented with evidence which contradicts contemporary theories, you can conveniently kind of leave it in a cellar somewhere in the bottom of a museum where it conveniently gets forgotten about or gets undermined in some way or not even reported. But certainly not kind of that put into a full public view. So that's cheating. That's not science. The tendency to make mistakes, again, another human defect. Though people may be honest, people may actually not purposely cheat. They purposely wanting to give a good perspective of life and the world and history around us, but they just simply make a mistake. They don't see something. It's simply due to their limited senses, imperfect senses, we cannot know everything. But when we have it, if we're dealing with imperfect senses, we do not know everything in archaeology. We haven't dug everywhere. We haven't explored every avenue of the earth or the sea. So we practice a very, very small amount. We think we know it all, but we don't. Along with making genuine mistakes or just human errors, along with the propensity to cheat and the propensity to be illusioned as well, just to be biased with a certain objective. For example, if you are on the payroll at a university or at an institution, or government payroll to, I don't know, prove the theory of evolution or something like that, or the rewards for your profession are greater if you actually play the game, as it were. You go with the contemporary narrative, the idea that, you know, we're becoming more civilized. If you go back further in time, we're basically all living in caves and we're so much happier now. So that narrative, and if you play into that narrative directly or indirectly, whether it's scientific theories, archaeology, or discovery, then you're rewarded. You get your promotion, or you get your article in the magazine, and so on and so forth. Whereas things where if someone is basically quite honestly trying to honestly teach Dharmic principles, where and you can see that these things, to use a modern expression, they get less hits. if you are make a big fool of yourself, if there's a controversy, if there's a big argument, then, you know, you put that on YouTube or elsewhere on social media, these get more hits and more likes. You know, kind of a cheap entertainment based on triviality. But if someone's giving a lecture on Dharma, if someone's giving a Bhagavatam lecture, then you can see less interest. Unless, of course, amongst the devoted community in the Dharmic community, they may appreciate it. But those numbers are quite small when compared with the overall population of the earth. So we're in the Kali Yuga, but we're also in Lord Titania's golden age as well, where we can chant Hare Krishna and use chanting as an umbrella. Kali's reign. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And this is how we all know it, but this is how we become freed from the influences of this rotten Iron Age of Kali Yuga. I'll just mop up, or just finish off with a few concluding points, if I may. I've gone through quite a lot, actually. I don't think there's anything I missed out. I think that's basically it. What I would say, I think, is making this relevant for the verse 118.5 of the Bhagavatam. The Prabhupada writes, the personality of Kali has entered the jurisdiction of this earth long ago. You've got to remember that the Kali Yuga isn't just once. There's a cycle of 4.3 million years. And the Kali Yuga, of course, comes around once in every cycle. So Kali, it doesn't disappear forever. He comes back he becomes stronger when it's his time, when it's his allotted time. But he entered the jurisdiction of the earth long ago, before the reign of Maharaja Pritchard, but obviously it hadn't fructified by that time. But the way of a good government is to destroy disturbing elements who always try to extend their nefarious activities. So in other words, for example, how can we make this relevant? What would a good leadership do today? Well, according to Prabhupada's purport here, a good leadership would actually be really trying to stamp out animal slaughter, for example, or these other aspects, or gambling, or meat eating, and so on and so forth. But actually, most governments are actually trying to increase them because their priority is the economy. Now, obviously, we need a good economy, but do we need an economy which is actually based on animal slaughter? Should we be opening up like casinos and things connected with gambling just because it's, oh, it provides jobs, you know? Oh, it's okay because the local casino, we're going to turn, part of England into Las Vegas. Oh, that's okay because lots of people in there got jobs. And okay, I mean, we understand it's not a bad thing to seek jobs, especially now, but not in items or institutions which actually facilitate Kali's objective. What to speak of slaughterhouses? What to speak of all the meat and fast food industries and so forth? These things are awful from the point of view of the Vedic emperor. And the Prabhupada actually did mention a few times that, the first thing, to do would, if they were, the world turned to ISKCON or Prabhupada or his disciples said, okay, do what you wish. The first thing you would do is to stop animal slaughter. It would be nice. And there's so much animal slaughter goes on. I mean, my guess would be it would be a very tumultuous time. So it wouldn't be easy. There'd be lots of people that would try and stop you. And that's, I don't know how the world would respond to the likes of Maharaja Pritchard today is anyone's guess. But he would certainly rule with an iron fist, I think, and as he did during his time. But he would see, wouldn't he? He would say, my God, despite all this material, in some places around the world, there may be some material advancement. Spiritually, he would say, this place has gone to pot. Look at it. I mean, look at all the environmental disasters that we have. An area bigger than the size of Wales in Australia burnt. That was just a big forest fire. And then Oregon in America, similar principles. All kinds of storms, all kinds of climate change things going on, and sea levels rising and flooding and so forth. So these are all kind of inauspicious signs, and again, signs of the age of Kali. But the understanding is that we've, the demigods are not basically pleased with us, and therefore the demigods will not help us look after the earth. That's ultimately what's going on here. No one is offering sacrifices to the demigods. But this is the Vedic one. Of course, if you offer your life to Krishna, that the demigods are automatically satisfied. But in Vedic times, people would indeed offer blessings to the demigods for their blessings. But can we say that anyone's doing that? And thus, Mother Nature was very, very upset with us, I think, to say the least. And therefore, we're getting this reaction. Anyway, I'll stop there, if I may. And there may be one or two questions, and I may or may not be able to answer them. Well, thank you for listening. Thank you for tolerating me. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, dear Radhaman Prabhu. Thank you for a wonderful class. Very brilliantly dramatic and enlightening. We do have one question, obviously, from the temple room here at Bhaktivedanta Manor. Harika says, thank you, Prabhuji, for a wonderful and spiritually enlivening class based on the note you made that leaders should not be soft or else they'll be taken advantage of. Please, can you explain a little more on this, as if leaders are not soft to the idea of personalism in their dealing with devotees, will it not dilute the mood of loving devotional service to Krishna, which comes from the heart? And then there's a little second part to the question. Please, can you help explain the balance of a good leader, how a good leader emulates between being soft-hearted and respected for systematic management?
That's actually a really interesting and relevant and basically a good question. Of course, when I was talking about Maharaj Parikshit and other ideal leadership, ruling with an iron fist, so to speak, and of course this was in order to combat the influence of the age of Kali and the rise of non-devotion, the idea of a good leader would be intolerant of deviation, for example, in society as a whole. When the question here seems to be talking about within, for example, temple environments and so forth, which is a bit different between Vaishnavas. All leaders have to be strong, by the way. In terms of the exchange between Vaishnavas, whether senior or junior, or whether in a position of power or in a position of being perhaps a bit more subservient, you know, whatever one finds oneself in within a devotional environment, it's a kind of a different kettle of fish, is my maybe not the best example, but you know what I mean by that. The context of the verse and the context of my class really was about world leadership, Kshatriya leadership, reminiscent to that of Maharaj Yudhisthira, Parikshit, and the even world leaders today, and how they have to be strong because the majority of the population are not Vaishnavas. And if you do not stop meat eating, for example, then the tendency will be in the education that people will just do it. People tend to go to the lowest common denominator. But I did also mention that even when you're talking about like leading a country or something, that it's important for the leader to set example. Even today, politicians are expected to some degree set an example. For example, if you have, a leading politician in the West who does something wrong, they're caught with some scandal, then they tend to lose the election if the scandal is big enough. I mean, as a Kali Yuga goes by, not even that will, people won't even care about that. But to some degree, even today, people are a little bit kind of attached to truthfulness. If a politician is known to lie a lot, they tend to kind of lose credibility and so forth. So even in that context, setting in some degree of example, some degree of good character is even understood today. And what does now amongst Vaishnavas and temples or in doing devotional service, that is absolutely paramount to it. So hopefully in a situation where leaders in spiritual institutions should be spiritual, because we are the Brahmanas, actually. If you're in a temple environment, you are automatically really within the Brahmanic or Vaishnava Brahminical kind of culture. And Brahmanas, and we're not Kshatriyas. It's different. We're not ruling a country. We don't have a horse. We don't have a palace. We are Vaishnavas, which are above Brahmanas. All Vaishnavas can do the work of anyone, of any so-called caste. But Vaishnava is beyond that because we're devotees of Krishna. So I would say that even then, however, sometimes managers and leaders have to make difficult decisions sometimes. And, you know, but to behave like a Vaishnava, regardless of what pressure they're under, I think is absolutely important as well. And particularly in our environment where we should know better. we should be in control of our senses and so forth. However, I think the main point really is that even ISKCON, or to speak of the world, or other institutions, cannot be driven purely by sentimentality. It's just not, there's nothing wrong with a bit of sentimentality, but sentimentality on its own is not going to get you very far. You need to have that blend. If someone is a kshatriya or manager, then someone, you know, does have to have some of those kind of qualities that help with them. If someone just wants to concentrate purely on study, simplicity, renunciation, kindness, softness, that's fine. Those are all Brahminical qualities. That's why in Vedic times, actually, the Brahmana's role was quite different and distinctive from the ruling class, because the Brahmanas were concentrating on their meditations, on their chanting, and their prayers, their sacrifices, and their reading, and certain doing their blessings, and so forth. But and they would be consulted by the leaders, the kshatriyas, but they wouldn't actually themselves kind of, you know, those Brahmanas wouldn't use an iron fist, so to speak. But anyway, yeah, so to answer that question in one sentence, within devotional environments, we have to take on as many Brahminical qualities as we can, even in leadership. That's the answer to the question. I hope that's satisfactory for everyone.
Very good response. Thank you, Prabhu. Thank you for your nice answer. I covered a lot of ground in that response, actually.
That was a very polite way of saying I went on too long.
No. Actually, because the question draws out all of those points that you've mentioned. It talks about the systemic management. It talks about different aspects of leadership. So you seem to have covered all of those aspects for us. You also mentioned how, obviously, this movement, Lord Chaitanya's movement for 10,000 years, and Kali is a long way off till finishing. It's got his, you know, 432,000 years. We've only had something around 5,000. So what would, currently we think the condition of the world is somewhat, you know, precarious as it is due to the amount of wars that are going on. You mentioned about natural disasters, you mentioned about, you know, other ailments that are happening. Look at what's happening now in terms of pandemic and so on. How the condition of the world will be after the 10,000 year period has sort of passed?
Well, I love those kind of questions. I wouldn't like to be around in 10,000 years from now. So the understanding is that some people would say, well, how can we even be in the golden age of Lord Chaitanya with all this going on? There's so many bad things going on. First World War, Second World War, and everything else. I mean, what's so golden about that? And the answer is that the golden age of Lord Chaitanya is slowly phasing in, and the holy name is available. So for those who are taking shelter of the holy name, they are in the golden age. They are protected with that umbrella of the holy name. And Lord Chaitanya has made that available to all of us. Now, however, the more that the Hare Krishna mantra is known, spread, and chanted, then the golden age will become more manifest to us and the world around us. But however, I have a feeling that things may have to get worse before they get better. And it may be that at some point people will just get so fed up of material life that people will, in fact, we can already see it in many quarters. A lot of young people. I actually think even the rise of veganism now among a lot of university-age people is a good sign. These are all kind of signs, I think, of actually directly or indirectly influenced by the golden age of Lord Chaitanya. I mean, not directly, but certainly. Can you imagine a veganism rising 100 years ago or something? It's not because these things that this. There are movements about for different ways of thinking. So the understanding is that as time goes by, there will be a polarization, but things will actually get better in the very long term, in terms of if you look at it for 5,000 years or whatever, in the middle of the golden age by then, things will actually be better. But by the end of 10,000 years, it was, you know, after 5,000 years, it will start to slope out again. And then after 10,000 years, then basically the holy names, Vedic rituals, and all these things, religion as we understand it to be, will be lost. And Prabhupada actually once answered one of his disciples and said, with a similar question, and said, after 10,000 years, you eat me, I eat you. It's going to be heavy. What's going to happen is that people will return to intense bogus simha and keli simha, lion-like sense gratification, lion-like sports and entertainment. So the world will become opulent through its highest activities, but then it will be misused, and then basically things will degrade very, very rapidly after 10,000 years. The understanding is that the holy name will not be chanted, or any mantra, any genuine mantra, actually. And then it's described actually in the Kalki Purana that, you know, by the time you get through halfway through Kali Yuga, basically there'll be no such things as marriage, there'll be no such things as anything, any culture, any kind of culture you can imagine will be gone by halfway through Kali Yuga. By the time you get to the second half of Kali Yuga, each other will be the staple diet. It sounds like, you know, there'll be droughts, will be, you know, large parts of the earth will be desert. There'll be, you know, the winds, the people will be suffering so much from the elements. The disease will be rampant. The earth, Mother Earth, will no longer be giving anything. Because by this time, no one's a devotee, by the way. There won't be any religion at all. It will just be a basis of survival. If there is any technology around by then, it will be used negatively, because that's also there. Just because it's a spiritual decline doesn't mean that materially there won't be civilization or so-called civilizations that come up. Anyway, the point is, by the end of Kali Yuga, then society will be, well, there won't be society really. It'll just be a mad scramble of different tribes fighting each other, eating each other for survival, really. It's described, it's a bit of a horrible thing for Friday morning, but you asked the question, so here we go. That mothers will basically eat their own babies just to survive. In fact, they'll have babies to eat them. That's how bad things will get. And they will be filled with the lowest possible imaginable. You wouldn't even call them human by then. It would be, you know, they would be subhuman or subhumanoid monsters. Anyway, so the whole idea is not to be around by then. Because when you think about it, that would be the result of the very worst souls, if you like, taking birth, you know, on the earth, from around everywhere throughout history, throughout the universe, taking birth on the earth, bringing that karma with them. The people, the souls that have completely, after so many opportunities, have just rejected any kind of piety, any kind of concept of God, and they'll end up there. Yet, Kalki will come and basically kill them all to end the age of Kali. So there you go. So something to think about over breakfast, I think.
I think I'll skip breakfast for now.
Well, you know, don't have a Kali Yuga staple diet. That's all I can
No.
say. Have some nice Krishna prasadam.
Indeed. Thank you again, Prabhu. amazing class, as always. Hope that we are united again in person in the temple room very, very soon. Things will improve and you can give a class again in person. Until then, I'm sure we will hope to meet you online. Thank you again.